Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man of uncommon intelligence, who we're very pleased to say treats us to it each week, is Gordon Chang, the author of two terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. You can find his writings at the Daily Beast, and he appears regularly at Fox News, but also as a weekly feature of this program. Gordon, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Frank.
Well, speaking of North Korea taking on the world was treated to the spectacle, I think that's the right term for it, of a North Korean-South Korean summit last week. Tell us what you made of it, Gordon, and what, if anything, is likely to come of it.
This really was a stunning development. You had the leaders of the two Koreas, the third inter-Korean summit, but the first one where the North Korean leader went to the South. What is really interesting are the comments that Kim gave to Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president, as reported by the New York Times and other media outlets. And in it, Kim says that he is willing to actually give up all of his weapons in exchange for two things. One of them is a pledge by the United States not to attack North Korea, and the other is the signing of a peace treaty to formally end the Korean War. Of course, there are traps there, but what is striking about this, Frank, is that the cost of giving up his arsenal is so low. Now, of course, we don't agree, you know, no one thinks that Kim is actually being serious. But what this says, though, is something that we haven't seen before. In the past, North Korea has made concessions during nuclear negotiations. But really, this is the first time I can remember of North Korea giving concessions even before talks begin. And I think that's a testament to how effective President Trump's policy has been to coercing North Korea.
Well, that's one take on it. Let's tease it out, Gordon Chang. The South Koreans are, as you and I have talked about on many occasions, very, very keen on what was previously called the Sunshine Policy of unification with North Korea on terms that certainly seem to be more to the liking of Kim Jong-un than Donald Trump, I would think, and one would expect most in South Korea as well. Is that misreading what the South Korean president is up to? And if it's anything like that, Gordon, what does that mean in terms of President Trump's efforts to achieve the kind of transformation that you've just talked about?
Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president, is very much a pro-North Korean sympathizer, not only his own views, but because we can't peer inside Moon's mind. What's really disturbing are his senior advisors, the people that he chose to help him lead South Korea. Those people, many of them, were in their youths pro-North Korean advocates. They were members of Juche Revolution groups, and some of them have refused to disavow their earlier views. So when you see pictures of Moon and Kim, you're seeing two people who very much support North Korea. Now, this ordinarily would be a monumental problem for the United States, but most South Koreans are not on board with what their president wants to do. And so the United States has plenty of room to actually win hearts and minds in South Korea. And President Trump has done a fairly good job of boxing Moon in, of preventing Moon from doing what he otherwise would want to do. So there is, of course, a lot of risk in this situation, but nonetheless, the United States has the upper hand. And certainly with the new ambassador, Admiral Harry Harris, who is yet to be confirmed, but I'm sure will be, the United States will have a very good team in place to deal with Moon and, of course, Kim as well.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I was very pleased to see John Bolton over the weekend talking once again very decisively that if Kim Jong-un is prepared to eliminate all of his nuclear weapons, then there'll be no problem finding a place for them to sit down and talk about doing just that. That's the big if, I think, still. You know, I had Admiral James Ace Lyons on the show last week, Gordon, and he made a comment which seems to me to be both astute and a good guide to policy, and that is, China, of course, has been a big factor in all of this. It's not entirely clear to me how constructively, but I'd like to get your thoughts on that. But one of the constructive things that it could certainly do to facilitate the certain end of Kim Jong-un's nuclear threats to the United States would be to recover the so-called transporter erector launchers that the Chinese sold or gave the North Koreans, on which to move around covertly the missiles with which they're threatening us. Would you talk about that idea?
If we're going to have a good deal with North Korea, it's not only going to be for them to give up all their nuclear weapons, it will be for them to give up all their ballistic missiles, and not just the long-range ones. The short-range ones affect and threaten Japan. And we can't make a deal that's just good for us, but leaves our allies out in the open. So yes, Admiral Lyons is absolutely correct. If there's going to be a deal, we have to make sure that we get back the transporter erector launchers. I wouldn't actually let China take them back. I would take them ourselves. You know, with regard to your broader question about China's role in all of this, one of the good things that happened on March 8th when President Trump accepted Kim's offer for direct talks was that we cut the Chinese out of the room. You know, if you look back over the last 2 years, China's sanctions enforcement is much better than it was 2 years ago. But if you're going back only 2 months, there's been a marked deterioration in China's sanctions enforcement. And I think what's going on right now is that Beijing, on the sidelines, wants to get back in. And the way it's trying to do that is to give Kim Jong-un reasons that he doesn't have to deal with the United States and the international community. So right now, Beijing is playing a very dangerous game. We're going to learn a little bit more after we hear about Wang Yi, the Chinese foreign minister, going to Pyongyang this week. I hope that we learn of what the substance of discussions. We well may not, but nonetheless, we can suspect that the Chinese, like they've done from time to time and during the six-party talks, are being a malign influence on balance.
Yeah, that is a great concern, I think, Gordon Chang. And not least the fact that after President Trump surprised the Chinese and, as you say, cut them out, it was, I recall, the trip that Kim Jong-un made to Beijing that suggests that there was some consultation, if not actual coordination of policy between the Chinese and the North Koreans. So that game is being played, and I suspect the foreign minister will be continuing it in the days ahead. Gordon, it's so important for us to understand as much as we can what these dynamics that are likely to complicate the president's efforts are about, and your clarity on them, and in particular, the extent to which they are actively aimed at undermining the president, needs to be really squarely confronted, it seems to me, by the president and his team. But as you say, also, I think he does have a good team to help him do that now. Gordon, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for your time. I know you'll come back to us again next week. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. Next up, we will speak with Anne Sirach about the latest developments in terms of the swamp in Washington and what they mean for you. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are joined by Anne Sirach. She has been doing, I think, incalculably important work in helping the rest of us understand the public mood, particularly with respect to what's happening inside the Beltway, the dreaded Washington Beltway. And specifically, she is the driving force behind the Frontier Lab's Ear to the Ground project, which has done some important polling, including one just released last week, the poll conducted by John McLaughlin. Among other things, Anne Sirach is the principal of Sirach Research Group, which identifies new dimensions of American opinion using cutting-edge market research methodologies, and with a specific interest in how they are used to change behavior and minds. She's always a welcome guest here, and thank you so much for coming back to talk a bit about your newest poll and some of its really quite important findings, I think.
Thank you. I'm excited to talk with you about them and see what they mean about the future.
Well, seeing what they mean about the future is particularly interesting. Let's talk about what they have determined about the public sentiment. Remind us who was polled and why that's particularly instructive in terms of where we are in this, well, in this election year and looking forward already, I guess, to the next presidential campaigns.
Yeah, so we looked at 1,000 likely voters, and likely voters is the key phrase there. Most of the polls, I think, that you will see from the mainstream pollsters aren't looking at likely voters. And that means that they're overrepresenting people who aren't going to be voting. And in general, in the market research community, we see most of the polls that are put out there into the news as oversampling Democrats. So this is considered to be a more better representation of how the actual electoral landscape looks.
And this is one of the things I think that distinguishes John McLaughlin, that has made his polling more accurate than many. But having said all that, as I recall your data, the number of Democrats is larger in this population you surveyed than is the number of Republicans or certainly independents. Is that right?
Yes, it's slightly larger there. So you could even say that this is a pessimistic view, but when you hear the result, that will mainly make those of us who are seeking a pathway out of what we're calling the swamp even more heartened.
Yeah. Now talk a little bit about that term. We throw it around a lot. It's kind of like the deep state. It recalls to mind that Supreme Court justice's famous quip that we may not be able to define pornography, but we know it when we see it. We certainly know the swamp and the deep state when we see them. But what do you think most people mean when they hear that term, or are thinking when they hear that term, the swamp?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that, and that is one of the goals of this research, was to see exactly how Americans define it. So there is a general sense that it's the element of combination of elected officials, unelected officials, media, et cetera, that is boxing the American people out of having self-governance. But there was a little bit of nuance there across the ideological spectrum. So we did find overall that everyone has a distaste for this swamp-like effect, this murkiness, this antithesis of, sending your elected officials to Washington and they represent you.
Mm-hmm. And this was true across the political spectrum, I think, is what you are getting at. Is that right?
Right. That across the political spectrum. In fact, if there's any issue that could win over moderates and independents, this is it. And Democrats. And we saw 55% of voters were concerned about it. 66% of Republicans. That number goes up even higher when you start to define the swamp. So we began by asking about the swamp as a term and then defining it. And people, when you define it, people become even more concerned.
Yeah. And what did you find they consider to be so problematic about the swamp when it comes, evidently, and Sirach, to a disconnect between their own personal preferences and what is being done by the swamp?
Well, one of the things I think most interesting about the swamp is that it isn't just issues sort of being sucked into the swamp and not addressed. It's really an emotional sense that their representatives are not with them. They're not on their side. So one of the questions we polled was if Americans agreed or disagreed that their elected officials share their level of concern about threats to their freedom. And so that was one of the elements that gets at the psychological aspect of the swamp. It's not just that they're sending people to Washington and they're getting taken away by special interests. It's that they're not psychologically with the American people. They're not fighting for them. And so when, 53% of Americans said that their elected officials do not share their level of concern, as an example.
And one of the things that I found interesting about it was you seem to find that those responding in this manner, many of them, not all obviously, but many of them were more closely aligned with Donald Trump than they were with their representatives. And that seemed especially true of the House congressional leadership. And am I right, Ansarok, that in your ear-to-the-ground poll, that you discovered one of the tests of swampiness, if I could use that expression, was the degree to which people were really resisting the sorts of things Donald Trump ran on, and in many cases, the Republicans especially, themselves ran on in the last election cycle?
I think that this should be a wake-up call to the Republican leadership. We asked point blank, is the Republican leadership helping to drain the swamp or supporting the swamp? And 46% of Americans, overall Americans, 46% said that the Republican leadership was supporting the swamp. But that was 32% of Republicans. So a third of Republicans feel their own party is supporting the swamp. It's quite distressing, I think, if you are a swampy Republican.
Right. Well, look, I have the feeling that the bigger issue is that they are the swamp. They're not just supporting it. And that's the really interesting thing here. And as you know, we've got a certain degree of swampiness, again, to use that phrase, on both sides of the aisle. It seems to be the thing that the establishment has rather more in common, whether it's left or right, Republican or Democrat, with each other than it does with the vast majority of Americans out there who are indicating, with your poll at least, that they're not happy about this state of affairs. Which brings me to, so what do we do about this? There is, as you know very well, a considerable sense that this is not going to turn out well in 2018 if this public has this kind of attitude towards the existing Congress. Republicans will perhaps simply stay home, if not moved by a congressional leadership that has seemingly gone swampy on them. And Democrats, of course, are happy to turn them all out and turn it over to Nancy Pelosi. Talk us through that as you see it. Crystal ball.
Well, right now, I think a lot of the results we're seeing are being propped up by Trump voters who are remaining loyal. And they're being just slapped down by these people, ridiculed, ignored by the GOP leadership. And yet they are the ones who are allowing the Republicans to show any vestige of, support right now as we're looking at the midterms coming up. So we see two things. The first is that, believe it or not, and you probably may believe it, the conservative base is Trump. So that is an interesting finding from this. But the other thing is that they are giving them no reason to turn out in the election. And they're not pulling over what this poll is showing is a huge opportunity. Independents and moderates are very supportive of draining the swamp.
That's a key finding. Yeah. So as you were sort of suggesting a moment ago, Ansarok, you could actually pull in a bipartisan and tripartisan, I guess you might call it, though the independents, of course, are not partisans in the sense of having a political party. But they nonetheless are a faction that could make for a winning coalition where one seems to be absent at the moment. In fact, I was with a prominent, very influential conservative leader yesterday who opined privately that if the election were held today, the Republicans may lose as many as 75 seats in the House, which would not only turn the House over to the Democrats, of course, but presumably assure that there would be plenty of people to impeach Donald Trump if they have that chance. So this, there's a lot riding on this, of course, and one of the issues that has arisen in light of all of this is what to do about this congressional leadership, which your poll suggests is in very, very bad odor with many of these voters, not just Republicans. Do you have a sense of how this is likely to play out in terms of leadership races and timing and winners in the House?
What we can say is that the Republicans still have a path to keeping their majority. With this poll being out there, they cannot say they do not know what that path is. And so we will be left with wondering why they did not act. And so I believe that we are now getting the true sense of what the motivations of Republican leadership is. The do-nothing Congress is a direct lockstep with the swamp. So we no, there's a path to keeping the majority.
And how would you describe that very succinctly?
Draining the swamp. That is the path. Not right now. The Republican majority has high disapproval and they're tied to the swamp. We know there's conservative, independent and moderate support for draining that swamp. That is the path for them. And so we will only be left with wondering why they didn't take that path.
And with incredibly ominous implications for doing so. Well, Ann Sorok, you can lead a horse to water, as they say. Let's hope that this horse will be made to drink properly from the right sorts of stream and not the swamp, that's for sure. We look forward to further visits with you. Check out, folks, by the way, Paul Bedard's two terrific columns at the Washington Examiner about this poll, one just out today, as a matter of fact. Next up, we will speak with Bill Marshall of Judicial Watch. We'll get the latest from him on the Clinton machine. That and more, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is a pleasure to be able to reintroduce to you all a man that I've come to admire greatly for his expertise in and, well, daring do with the black arts of investigative research and journalism. He is Bill Marshall. These days he is doing that black magic at a fabulously important organization, Judicial Watch, where he is a senior investigator. He has been involved in the investigative business for the U.S. government in the past, as well as for the private sector. He is also a contributor at American Thinker, where we have been seeing some of his materials, as well as at Judicial Watch. So let me talk to you a little bit. First of all, let me say welcome, Bill Marshall. It's good to have you back.
Well, thank you very much for having me back, Frank. It's a pleasure.
The pleasure is mine. I wanted to call to our audience's attention, Bill, an important piece that you recently published at Judicial Watch's site about the Clinton machine. It never seems to quite go away, does it? But specifically, some of the revelations you've stumbled across in the course of your work with Judicial Watch, investigating the Clinton emails, of which there are a prodigious number that have still not yet been made public. Specifically, Bill, you caught my eye with information about how the Clinton machine seems to be tainted by anti-Semitism. Tell us about that.
Right, right. Well, these, I should preface by saying that these are emails that, as you alluded to, were not turned over by Hillary to the State Department. We actually got these as a result of the FBI's investigative work into the Clinton email abuse. They turned up 72,000 pages of emails. Now, remember, Hillary only turned over something like 30,000 emails. So these are emails that she did not, that she thought she had deleted, or that she just simply did not turn over to the State Department.
And when you say she had deleted, that almost certainly means people working for her deleted it. I can't imagine that she was actually doing it any more than she was busting up phones and Blackberries.
Right. Right. So we're talking about Hillary, the collective, the Hillary machine. So I think that makes them particularly relevant, right? Because she didn't want them out there, or her people didn't want them out there. The one particular email that kind of caught my attention, and which I referenced at American Thinker last April 27th, was an email that was sent by Philip Raines, who was a top State Department official and a long-term sort of political apparatchik working for Hillary in her campaigns. At the time, he was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Strategic Communications. So he sent an email on August 1st, 2010, to Hillary's top confidants. So it would be Huma Abedin, Cheryl Mills, Jake Sullivan, and Lona Valmoro, as well as CCing AJS, which I think is Andrew J. Shapiro, who was then Assistant Secretary of State. And in the email, he says, which has the subject line Jews, he says, "We spend so much time talking about meetings with Jewish members, Andrew giving speeches," I mean, presumably Andrew Shapiro, "her," meaning Hillary, "at AIPAC," which is the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, "but nothing to date is better than the photo of Mark with the yarmulke and talus." Now, Mark, we think, is maybe a reference. We're not certain, but maybe a reference to Chelsea Clinton's husband, Mark Mizvinsky. Tallies, of course, is a is a reference to a Jewish prayer shawl, and a yarmulke is a skull cap, both of which are worn by Orthodox Jewish men during prayer, typically. So, the email was, I thought, was a little disconcerting in the sense that, just by the subject line, they're singling out Jews as an ethnic bloc. And that's never a good thing, to say the least, right?
Well, and somewhat cynically, it sounds, from what you've said.
Well, it is. The email, the impression you get is that Reince feels they're spending too much time catering to Jews. And of course, one of the recipients on that email, Huma Abedin, as your organization and the Center for Security Policy has documented so well over the years, is a member of a family that is very, very deeply connected to Islamist groups, Muslim Brotherhood affiliated groups.
Right. Sharia supremacists through and through.
Exactly. Sharia supremacists. And her father and her mother both actually were very senior, are very prominent players in that, in the Islamic
enterprise.
Yes, we'll put a project, for lack of a better word. And of course, back in 2009, approximately a year earlier, Huma had sent herself an email, which was a bit disturbing, to Doug Band, her partnering crime at the Clinton Foundation.
That may not be a figurative turn of phrase in this case, might it?
Right. I mean it figuratively.
Possibly literally, too. Yeah.
Right. The FBI purportedly is investigating the Clinton Foundation, so we'll see if any criminal charges are eventually brought.
Because this would have been the nexus of the pay-to-play between Hillary Clinton's State Department offices and her foundation interests.
Right. And in fact, our press release, Judicial Watch press release, the last one, which alludes to this most recent batch of emails, discusses that pay-for-play corruption extensively. And we go into significant detail about some of the new information that was uncovered. So back in 2009, Huma sends this email to her good buddy, Doug Band, who is a top aide to Bill Clinton and a top official at the time at the Clinton Foundation. And they, they're, as you say, they're sort of the bridge, they're the nexus there between, which essentially made the State Department and the Clinton Foundation almost one entity, in terms of the pay-for-play corruption. But back in 2009, Huma sends an email, has an email exchange with Doug Band. Doug Band had asked her if Bill Clinton could give a speech at AIPAC. AIPAC had requested, again, this is the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. They had requested the Bill Clinton speak at their conference that year. And in the exchange, Huma replies back to Band, "You really want to consider sending him into that crowd?" Right.
One can almost see the sneering of the lip, right?
Well, exactly. And that's why I said this is sort of a troubling undercurrent, if you will, among these top echelon of Clinton advisors that I think should really be concerning to everyone. But that email, I believe, was uncovered by the Daily Caller back in 2016, and it elicited, as you can imagine, a somewhat negative response from many of the prominent Jewish communities in the United States, as it should have.
Well, she concluded, as I recall, with the statement, quote, "no go to AIPAC," unquote. So it wasn't just that she was sort of sneering at the whole thing. She was putting the kibosh on Bill Clinton going to AIPAC. Bill, listen, wait, we're going to run out of time before we run out of things to talk to you about this. I did want to just take advantage of your expertise and the study that you've done. You're kind of compliment us, but you've done your own on Huma Abedin and her role both with the Family Muslim Brotherhood Enterprise, the Institute for Muslim Minority Affairs, as well as the role that she played inside Clinton world and promoting Muslim Brotherhood organizations and interests, it seems rather assiduously. This is, of course, of particular interest because at the moment in the state of Michigan, there's a bit of a controversy over someone who happens to be running for governor. He's a state senator up there, but he's begun talking about this idea that the Muslim Brotherhood has called civilization jihad. And it basically means, as you know, the kind of influence operations, penetration, subversion, of which, frankly, I think Hillary Clinton's right-hand gal, Huma Abedin, is the poster child. And yet it seems as though people both on the Republican side of the aisle as well as the Democratic side have taken to task this this fellow Patrick Kolbeck over having simply pointed out that this is a real phenomenon and a problem in the state of Michigan for sure, but elsewhere across America as well. Your thoughts?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you recall that the sort of opprobrium that and the derision that Michelle Bachmann and four other, I think Louis Gohmert may have been one.
Yep, Trent Franks and two others.
2012, right? Sent a letter to the State Department, the Inspector General, saying, you know, you really seriously need to investigate Huma Abedin having such troubling radical Islamic organizational connections and her family. Being in such a powerful position within the State Department and having a top secret security clearance, you know, the left would tend to say, well, these are, you know, this is guilt by association. Well, you know what? I had a top secret clearance. You did too. They did background, you know, with full field background investigations on us. If we had questionable associations, that was grounds enough for denying a security clearance. Having a security clearance is not a right, it's a privilege. And that's that everyone understands that who's gone through the process.
And the reason the associations matter, Bill Marshall, is, you know, having, you know, spent your life in the investigative field work and the like, is because those relationships can bear on whether you may be a compromised individual, a security risk, perhaps even an agent for hostile entities. I'm not saying that anybody we've talked about necessarily was an agent, but I'm certainly saying that's why they get excluded when those associations are properly recognized and entered into the calculus as to whether security clearance is the privilege, as you say, of a security clearance is conferred. Bill Marshall, there's so much more to talk about. We didn't get anywhere close to what else is in those 72,000 pages of documents that Hillary Clinton apparently had a fair number of classified documents, including, among other things, about the Middle East peace process. But that will be for another day, I hope very soon. Thank you for your time today and the extraordinarily important work you and your colleagues do at Judicial Watch. I hope you'll come back to us, as I say, in the very near future. Next up, we will speak with Dr. Charles Lipson. We'll get another take on what the Clinton machine has been doing, and what lengths law enforcement and the intelligence community went as sort of, well, weaponized agencies to protect them. That and more right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It is a delight to have with us, I believe for the first time, Dr. Charles Lipson. He is a professor of international relations at the University of Chicago. He is the author of several important books, including Reliable Partners: How Democracies Have Made a Separate Peace. He's also an active contributor, thankfully, to Real Clear Politics. And several of his recent pieces caught my eye because of both the clarity with which they describe some things that have been rather murky. We were talking in the previous segment about the swamp. One particularly murky piece of the swamp, of course, is involved what's been going on at the Department of Justice and the Department's Federal Bureau of Investigations. And here to help us think our way through that and what it means for all of us, I'm very pleased to say, is Dr. Lipson. Sir, welcome. It's so good to have you. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to talk with you, Frank.
Let me ask you about a piece that you've recently written, as I say, that I found intriguing and very ominous, really, and that is the extent to which there is a hidden bombshell, as you put it, in the Department of Justice's Inspector General's report on the activities of Andrew McCabe. Tell us what that bombshell is, and if it goes off, what effect it might have.
I think that real bombshell in the end is that McCabe has been caught out in a bunch of falsehoods. And because he's been caught out in them, he will almost certainly have criminal liability, especially because the special counsel had taken a guilty plea on a false statement from Mike Flynn.
Lying to the FBI is discouraged, it seems, at least for some people. But for McCabe as well, do you think?
Well, I think McCabe is in real trouble. But I think there are a couple of other things that will put him in even deeper trouble, which is, remember all this talk that has been about Strzok and Lisa Page, the paramours who are cheating on their spouses and did all the text messaging. They're still at the FBI, and you sort of want to ask yourself why they haven't been fired. And the normal reason in Washington would be sort of the swamp, you can't fire anybody. I don't think that's the case here. I think what is the case is that they're cooperating with the inspector general, who could no longer interview them or require them to be interviewed if they were fired from the agency. I think it's also the case that we haven't heard from Strzok's boss, who's the head of the counterintelligence division, a guy named Priestrap, who also, I think, must be cooperating. If that is all true, they will have the crown jewels about interagency efforts plus FBI only efforts to clear Hillary Clinton in an investigation and to get wiretaps on people close to Trump without full authorization.
Now, this would have been, of course, in the midst of the 2016 campaign. This is not contemporaneous.
This is a big deal for anybody who's interested in ensuring not only that the Russians don't meddle, but that our own spy agencies, which we give a huge amount of authority to, don't meddle in politics.
And you say intelligence and law enforcement agencies both. I mean, it's really the two instruments of the government that you don't want working against our democratic political system.
Absolutely. And in this case, the part of the FBI that was heavily involved, what Strzok and Page and their boss work for, is the counterintelligence side. So counterintelligence is not only spying, but it kind of differs from the rest of the FBI in one important sense. In most FBI cases, what you're trying to do is get testimony that you can deliver to a court in a trial, a criminal trial. But in counterintelligence, you're trying to prevent something or flip a spy or do something like that rather than necessarily get something before a court. This was a big change at the FBI in the aftermath of 9/11. They were people who caught criminals after the fact and brought evidence into court. But we didn't want to Islamic terrorists knocking down our buildings and then us treating them as criminals after the fact. We wanted to prevent it beforehand. So this agency in the FBI is really about that. The key point here, though, is that if they can flip McCabe, McCabe would know everything. He was the deputy to Comey, and he would not only know everything about Comey, he would know quite a lot about what went on in the Justice Department. And the bombshell that was in that report is that McCabe testifies, and the report does not dispute, that the number three person at the Department of Justice called McCabe and basically sought to quash an ongoing criminal investigation of the Clinton Foundation. Now, it is just inconceivable that he would have made that call on his own. It came from one of the two people above him, or possibly the White House. And the two people above him were the highest officials in the Department of Justice, including Loretta Lynch.
And Sally Yates, I assume, who was there after Lynch departed as the acting AG for a time.
She was number two. So you have a lot of people who, if McCabe is telling the truth about the call, or we need to hear from all of these people under oath before a grand jury about what happened in this call and how high up the food chain this went. I think that the reason you can wonder if it went further up is that one of the very plausible reasons, there are two very plausible reasons you wouldn't pursue the Clinton matter, email matter and server and all of that.
Matter, of course, being the term that Loretta Lynch insisted be used in her conversation with James Comey.
The matter, that's right. There are two plausible good reasons, either of which would be sufficient. One would be, you know, Hillary's already a candidate, and if you intervene at this point, you're killing the Democratic candidate. But the other is that Hillary and Barack Obama had emailed on private accounts, and if she's ultimately in trouble because she did it, she can in effect bring in the president or threaten to and say, hey, he must have known because he's emailing me too. And so that's implicit approval.
Yeah. Let me ask you, you have raised some fascinating issues here, not least of which is the implication of the weaponization, as I think you put it, of our intelligence and law enforcement agencies in this naked effort to help Hillary and hurt Donald Trump. And I think you're right. This is beginning now to take on the sort of character of a Greek tragedy, with these people all essentially destroying themselves before our very eyes. I did want to ask you about a chap who has been deeply involved, it seems to me, with a lot of this, but has thus far not been a focus of much attention, though he seems to be trying to bring as much of it to him as he can at the moment. And I'd ask you to sort of help me think that through. But his name is John Brennan. And John Brennan, of course, has an interesting background as a intelligence officer. He was the chief of station in Saudi Arabia some years back, became President Obama's first Homeland Security advisor, and then, of course, was appointed by him to run the CIA for the second term. A man who has made very little secret of his sort of political affiliations, going back to when he voted for the Communist Party as a young man. But what do you make of his role in all of this, Dr. Lipson? And do you think we're going to find him playing a role in this Greek tragedy as well?
We very well might. I actually think at this point, Clapper, who is the head of the overall intelligence system,
Director of National Intelligence, right, during the Obama years.
And therefore, in a way, Brennan's boss, is more vulnerable right now.
Dr. Charles Lipson, thanks for the work you do at the University of Chicago and for Real Clear Politics on behalf of all of us. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon and that the rest of you will do the same. Again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.